I ended up in treatment for the first time when I was 15 years old. And so that's where.
This is Kayla Leinenweber. I met her as I began talking to people who have gotten treatment for addiction.
And that started everything for the next 10 years of me being in and out of treatment facilities. I worked for a company that put me through treatment more times than they should have. And I ended up with Synergy as my option, basically, because there were no other options.
Synergy is a substance abuse treatment center in Memphis that has been around for more than 30 years. It's one of at least four in the area and 300 nationwide that require participants to work long hours for little or no pay. They call it work therapy. Kayla had insurance, but she had been in treatment so many times that her insurance company refused to pay for more. That severely limited the treatment options she could afford. So on October 18th, 2013, just a few months after Kayla's 25th birthday, her parents dropped her off at Synergy. For the first month, which is supposed to be the most intensive, she sat in peer group meetings that were mostly aimed at resolving roommate issues and breaking down the basics of addiction, lessons she'd been taught years earlier through other rehabilitation programs. At Synergy, she also attended Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, a group self-help method that doesn't actually require a licensed professional. Individual therapy was supposed to be once a week. She only recalls 3 30-minute sessions. The next month, she wrote in workbooks designed to help people reflect on their behavior and motivations, but she rarely went to therapy. Then, in the third month, the work therapy began. She and a few other women were sent to work at a Kellogg's food plant in Rossville, Tennessee, about 30 miles from the treatment center. For up to 12 hours a day, Kayla cleaned machine parts for making waffles with high-grade chemicals and little training. She says her time there became more about making money for Synergy than about getting treatment. Kayla recalls working alongside temporary employees who she said made $40 an hour. All her wages went straight to Synergy. She didn't mind it at first. She was happy to not be in Synergy's cafeteria writing in her workbook. But she no longer had any time for individual therapy because of her work schedule.
It's like, I'm doing all this goddamn work, and this place is still a shithole, nobody cares. Like, I'm doing this so that I can get therapy, so that I can get treatment, but this really seems like a prison rooming house.
In Kayla's case, there was no court order holding her there. But for many, it essentially was prison. As with many residential treatment centers, it's a mix of people. Some voluntarily seek out treatment for substance use disorders. Others are there on court-ordered treatment. They have to complete the program, unpaid work and all, or end up back in jail. But as we'll explore this episode, controversy surrounds this program model. Does it actually help people on their journey to recovery? Does work work? Is it even legal? This is Civil Wrongs, a podcast from the Institute for Public Service Reporting at the University of Memphis and WKNO-FM, supported by Report for America. Here in Season 3, we examine incidents that some interpret as forced labor, possible loopholes in the constitutional ban on slavery.
Raggedy, raggedy are we, just as raggedy can be. We don't get nothing for our labor, so raggedy, raggedy are we.
In part one, we talked to descendants of a sheriff's deputy and farm workers in Arkansas in the 1930s, involved in a case of judicially approved enslavement, so egregious that the FBI intervened. If you didn't listen to it, stop now and go back. We'll be here when you return. The racist caricature of lazy black people has been around a long time. In his book, Stony Road, which examines how racial discrimination survived the Civil War, Henry Louis Gates Jr. noted that just 2 days after President Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, the New York Times said freedom for black people may create more problems. Quote, if the proclamation makes the slaves actually free, there will come the further duty of making them work. This belief underscored the perceived authority of Earl Arkansas Sheriff's Deputy Paul Peacher to haul men off to forced labor. Nearly a century later, similar stereotypes of people with addictions may be driving approaches to their treatment. To get the long version of how this idea of work therapy came to be so entrenched, you must check out American Rehab, an 8-episode podcast series from Reveal and the Center for Investigative Reporting. Their work led two senators to ask the U.S. Government Accountability Office to look into possible labor law violations at treatment facilities that receive federal funding. That investigation is ongoing, and the federal agency expects to share results in summer 2024. Again, that podcast is American Rehab by Reveal. Okay, we're all caught up, so let's dive in. In 1938, 2 years after the incident in our previous episode, President Franklin Roosevelt signed the Fair Labor Standards Act into law. It was a huge and hard-fought win for the labor movement. The law set up basic workplace rules we take for granted today. Minimum wage, a 40-hour work week, overtime pay, and a fairly broad definition of who is considered an employee. Crucially, it established the Wage and Hour Division in the U.S. Department of Labor to enforce the law and monitor potential violations, which are the crux of recent legal challenges to work therapy programs nationwide. In one case, a homeless veteran in Asheville, North Carolina, said he was forced to work as a front desk attendant and driver for the shelter in exchange for his stay there. Some hours were paid, some were counted as mandatory community service. He sued and lost. In Northwest Arkansas, a federal judge ruled in 2019 that participants in a court-ordered program called DARP, which stands for Drug Alcohol Recovery Program, were entitled to wages for hours that they worked at Hinton Plastics, which was owned by a state senator. The judge said participants were utterly dependent on DARP for all their basic needs while in the program, and had the impossible choice between working for free or jail time. But this ruling was overturned on appeal. The U.S. Court of Appeals in St. Louis said they were not entitled to wages because they had no reason to expect to be paid. They were technically incarcerated. Hinton Plastics, the court said, was doing them a favor by hiring them at all because their, quote, checkered histories could have justified lower pay anyway. Then there's a group of more than 200 people in Louisiana and Texas suing an addiction treatment program called Cinecor. The program's participants, as reported by Reveal, worked for companies like Walmart, Shell, and ExxonMobil, but all their wages went to Cinecor in exchange for treatment, room, and board. A federal judge recently ruled the participants could sue the program together, known as a class action. The case is ongoing. And perhaps the biggest case in work therapy right now is another class action suit, this one against the Salvation Army. Yes, that Salvation Army. Known for their bell ringers and thrift stores, the Salvation Army is one of the nation's largest nonprofits. In 2022, Forbes ranked them fourth in donations from the public. They coordinate homeless and domestic abuse shelters, natural disaster response, summer camps, rent and utility assistance, food pantries, and on and on and on. And they run rehabilitation centers for substance abuse treatment. They've done this for more than a century. Here's an excerpt from one of their promotional videos.
Amazing grace.
How sweet the sound that saved
a crackhead,
drug addict,
alcoholic,
meth freak,
a wretch
like me.
Their residential work therapy program lasts about 6 months. Participants are required to work 8 hours a day, usually at the thrift store warehouses. They sort, move, pick up, or label donated clothes and household items. On their website, the Salvation Army says it provides, quote, spiritual, social, and emotional assistance for people who have lost the ability to cope with their problems and provide for themselves. The solution, from the organization's perspective, is to prepare participants to re-enter society by providing, quote, a structured environment combined with work experience in our family stores. But the lawsuits filed in 2022 in New York, Georgia, and Illinois argue that the nonprofit is using people in treatment as its unpaid workforce. If people do get paid, it's usually no more than $25 a week. All the participants suing the Salvation Army were there voluntarily and not on a court order. The lawsuits allege that participants, quote, work so many hours during the week that it leaves little time for them to focus on rehabilitation. It's estimated that at least 75,000 people would be affected by the court's decision. We reached out to the National Salvation Army headquarters, its Mid-South branch, and the law firm representing former participants for comment. They all declined. In court papers filed in the Illinois suit, lawyers for the Salvation Army characterized program participants as beneficiaries, not employees. They call their earnings, quote, a small gratuity to reward the progress of the beneficiary in the pursuit of his or her spiritual and social rehabilitation. This isn't the Salvation Army's first time in court over this. In 1990, the U.S. Department of Labor investigated the program after a participant complained. The nonprofit was then ordered to pay people in their work therapy program. Instead, the Salvation Army sued. Its leaders said participants weren't seeking jobs, they were seeking guidance. After an extensive lobbying campaign, Republicans and Democrats alike defended the organization's work. The government backed down. The Labor Department added a special instruction to their field operations handbook. Here's what they told their employees. The Salvation Army's position is that individuals in its rehabilitation program, called beneficiaries, are not employees under the Fair Labor Standards Act. Although the wage and hour division may not agree with this position, do not initiate compliance actions until receiving clearance.
You know, I do think the Department of Labor could probably take on a more proactive enforcement role here, but it probably would be unpopular.
Claremont Ripley is a labor lawyer. She says the big question is the very definition of employee. Courts, she says, have all kinds of tests to determine who is an employee based on the situation. For example, who's benefiting the most from the job? Some would say a person in a work therapy program or an intern might be getting more out of it than the employer. She says once employment has been established, labor laws apply.
If they're an employee, they're protected by the minimum wage and overtime laws and the Fair Labor Standards Act unless there's some exception.
Which is a gray area that work therapy programs tend to operate in.
Places that are providing board and lodging, like providing food and a safe place to stay, should be entitled to a credit for that. And there are structures in the law for how to do that legally. And they're not supposed to be making a profit on the food and the lodging. I mean, there's a lot of rules there.
She told me the stakes are high in these kinds of cases.
I mean, it's like we're creating two classes. If unpaid work therapy is going to be the norm and we are going to somehow say this is okay and legal, we are creating this whole class of people who are there even outside of qualifying for the social safety nets that are tied to employment. They're just passing time, not earning any income, but performing labor. I mean, how do they transition out of that with nothing in their pockets? Whether they're transitioning out of a homeless shelter or transitioning out of a rehabilitation treatment center, you know, we are not setting them up to succeed when they leave if they have not been allowed to earn money. We're setting them up to rely on something else when they leave.
And she says the practice reflects a dark history most Americans would like to think we're done with.
Like the history of these work therapy programs is this kind of paternalistic notion that idleness is terrible. So we must, you know, here is this category of people that need our help, and a way we can help them is by making them busy. If they're not idle, you know, they won't continue to have whatever problems they had.
That idea that work in and of itself is treatment is reflected in court cases after the Salvation Army's lobbying campaign. Judges in a 1996 case against the nonprofit said participation was, quote, solely rehabilitative, and their work would give them, quote, a sense of self-worth, accomplishment, and enabled them to overcome their drinking problems and re-enter the economic marketplace. there is another common thread between all these cases. Their arguments all rely on a 1985 U.S. Supreme Court case. That case, like the one in our previous episode, originated in Arkansas. We'll take a look at that after the break.
Hi, I'm Rob Grayson, Morning Edition host at WKNO-FM. You know, it's getting harder to remember a time before the city had NPR News. And that's because it's been 50 years since this station brought it to Memphis, along with everything else you've come to expect from listener-supported public radio. Our mission is still the same, excellence in broadcasting. What has changed is how we reach listeners, like via this podcast, a collaboration with the Institute for Public Service Reporting. So whether WKNO is on your radio, computer, iPhone, or smart speaker, you're still getting the best public media Memphis has to offer. Learn more about us or become a supporter at WKNOFM.org or download the WKNO app.
Hello again, Tony and Susan Alamo coming your way with another one half hour of the truth. Susie?
Tony and Susan Alamo, a pair of fundamentalist Christians, started a church in Hollywood in 1969.
Glory, glory, hallelujah.
They soon attracted a following of young people described in church literature as drug addicts, criminals, and hippies. In 1975, the Alamos moved their operation to a compound in northwest Arkansas. They lived in groups of 30 or more and shared everything. The community welcomed new adherents from all sorts of backgrounds, so long as they agreed to work for the church. The Alamos ran various businesses to fund the endeavor, including gas stations, restaurants, grocery stores, and their most famous enterprise, bedazzled denim jackets. You've probably seen them, or at least their knockoffs. They have airbrush designs and rhinestones to fill in the colors or letters. The so-called Tony Alamo of Nashville jackets sold for hundreds of dollars and were worn by celebrities from Dolly Parton to Burt Reynolds to Mike Tyson. A custom leather version appears on the cover of Michael Jackson's Bad album. Behind those jackets was an unpaid workforce at the Alamos compound, many of them children. The pressure was so intense for members to participate in the myriad businesses that it was gaining the reputation of a cult. As the group and the profits grew, so did scrutiny from the U.S. Department of Labor and the IRS. The Alamos contended that everyone in their organization worked for God, and paying them infringed on their freedom of religion.
The court will hear arguments first this morning in the Tony and Susan Alamo Foundation against the Secretary of Labor.
The U.S. government argued that the nearly 40 businesses propping up the church were so extensive and the followers so dependent on them for their survival that they should be subject to the Fair Labor Standards Act. But lawyers for the Alamos painted the businesses as religious activities and therefore should be protected under the First Amendment.
The associates operated several businesses. That's agreed, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, we call them activities.
Well, they were gasoline stations, clothing stores, grocery stores. They were activities, but
cafes or restaurants?
Restaurant.
Yes, sir.
Did they compete with other businesses engaged in the same activities?
Yes, there was some competition, but primarily those organizations, those entities, which I call activities and which you might refer to commonly known as business or commercial activities, they are conducted primarily to provide for the clothing, the housing, the food, the transportation, and communication of the members. That's the basic purpose of it.
That competition was one of the reasons the Fair Labor Standards Act was created in 1938. How could a business compete with another if one of them didn't have to pay for labor? The Alamos lost. The Supreme Court said in this case, the parishioners were actually employees and were therefore entitled to minimum wage and overtime pay, with appropriate deductions for room and board at the compound. This created a federal precedent for similar cases that forms the backdrop for work therapy litigation today. Here's Claremont Ripley.
In this case, what the court said is that the workers expected to be compensated in the form of food, shelter, clothing and any other benefits they received, that all of that counted as compensation. So they did expect to receive that benefit for their work, and therefore they weren't volunteering. They were doing it to get housing, to get food, and therefore it should be considered true employment.
But some treatment centers that implement the work therapy model say that, unlike the Alamos, they do not deny their participants food or housing when they're not working. Cinecor's lawyers say participants still receive food and shelter when they are in orientation, sick, or the weather keeps them from working. The Alamos, on the other hand, were very strict to the point where church members reported being denied food in the compound's cafeteria if they hadn't worked that day. Even though the church members were there voluntarily, and the church's lawyers argued they would happily sign over any wages they were owed to the church, the Supreme Court said no one can waive their rights as an employee. It would leave too much room for coercion and exploitation. This had sweeping implications for work therapy models, whether the participant was there voluntarily or through a court order. But despite the Supreme Court precedent, how that plays out in other cases is still hotly debated, if it makes it to court at all. So let's imagine for a moment that the legal issue of employment is settled. It still leaves us with a question. Does working actually help people with drug or alcohol addictions? As I began calling experts, I got an unexpected answer to this question. Many I reached out to, and these are people with decades of research and practice in recovery programs, had no idea what I was talking about. They did agree that substance misuse and unemployment are related. People with an addiction are more likely to be unemployed than people without an addiction. People with jobs are less likely to relapse. What the evidence doesn't show is the effect of work without pay. But a central tenet of many work therapy programs is that labor, keeping busy, in and of itself will help cure a substance abuse disorder. And if they can't stick it out, well, they weren't ready to take recovery seriously in the first place. This idea comes from a long line of stories we've been told about addiction, and especially people with addictions in the justice system, that just aren't true.
And I think particularly in the South, it's hard for us to let go of punitive type things and consider what might be therapeutic.
That's Marie Crossan, Executive Director of the Tennessee Association of Recovery Court Professionals. Her organization helps train and connect administrators of prison diversion programs. She says addiction is still viewed by the general public as a moral failure. So putting people to work without pay seems like a viable solution. And while Crossan believes that people should experience consequences for their actions, she says that the perceived public pressure for a tough love approach to substance misuse can even get more punitive when a crime has been committed.
And they've got families and they've got kids. Do you want them to come back into your neighborhood not having learned anything at all, just being punished, which we know doesn't really work? Or would you like them to perhaps be more productive citizens, better fathers and mothers, better spouses, getting a job?
So recovery courts aim to combat the stigma with a more tailored approach to reducing drug and alcohol crimes. But Crossan says when it comes to choosing the treatment provider, most of the power lies with the court.
I would say the vast majority of the time, the recovery court is going to choose based on the partnership they have. And here's why. It's best practice to have a small handful of treatment providers that you refer to, that you have built relationships with, so that you can have some back and forth communication about that person and how they're doing and what's going on with them.
Crossan's organization and others urge recovery court programs to partner only with treatment centers that use evidence-based practices. Work therapy has yet to make that cut. The truth is, addiction is a medical issue and a mental disorder, and it can be treated. Studies over the past 3 decades show how drugs and alcohol rewire the brain. It often takes more than willpower to fight cravings. But the myth of the moral failure persists.
We carry this idea that substance use disorders happen because someone has been
weak because someone has made bad choices, that there was something that is broken about you that led you to this decision.
This is Jennifer Carroll, a medical anthropologist and clinical researcher at North Carolina State University. Her research focuses on the lived experiences of people who use drugs and how policy affects them.
Based on the stories that our leadership and our trusted institutions have told us about drugs for the last century, that's a reasonable conclusion to come to, but it is very wrong.
Charles Tucker also thought he was dealing with a moral failure. In 2017, he was about to turn 22 and had some trouble with the law. So he voluntarily entered a program called Adult and Teen Challenge. It's been in Memphis for more than 50 years. His aunt found the organization online and liked the Christian messaging.
As far as the program, on the outside, they made it look like, hey, this is the greatest program. It's a Christian-based program. Your kids are going to get closer to God. It's going to help them with their recovery. And once I got in there, it was completely opposite.
He said they shaved his head as a military-like way of conforming to the group. He was put to work most of the day washing cars or performing various jobs at their thrift store called BAM, which stands for Business as Ministry. It's meant to be a year-long program to cultivate character through spiritual growth, responsibility, and community. Working in the organization's enterprises helps individuals, quote, find purpose, addressing some of the issues that might prevent them from maintaining employment after they graduate the program, according to their website. But according to Charles, Bible study was the only other activity they did besides work during the few months he stayed there. And to hammer home the program's punitive style, Charles told me about the time he played some unauthorized music while washing cars.
I was sent to a room to recite the whole entire Bible.
I had to write the Bible page by page,
like write it out.
Like all 66 books?
Yeah, it was the whole Bible.
Oh my God.
Adult and Teen Challenge runs programs all over the country and often participates in recovery court programs. While it advertises itself as a solution to addiction, it is not a licensed substance abuse treatment facility. We reached out to the Memphis program and global headquarters about what Charles told us and to get some information about how they operate, but we did not get a reply. We also did not receive a reply from Synergy, the Memphis treatment center you heard about in the beginning of this episode. On their website, Synergy says that most of its year-long program, about 10 and a half months, is dedicated to work therapy. It says, this extended treatment period allows clients to experience greater emotional exploration, time to process their core issues, internalize the disease process, and practice living a lifestyle of recovery. The website also says that revenue from the work therapy program supports nearly half of the costs of the treatment program. Participants are supposed to continue receiving individualized counseling, group counseling, and pursue adult education courses if they want. But as we heard earlier, that was not Kayla Leinenweber's experience. We called Synergy and left voicemails and emailed leadership to share what Kayla had told us, but we never heard back. She said when she got in trouble there, her name was added to a list posted for all to see. For her, those kinds of punitive measures can contribute to the shame that people in recovery already struggle with.
It's like trauma begets trauma. So put any drug addict, and I don't know why I'm going to cry, but like you just feel like nothing's going to get better. Nobody's listening and you're still a problem. And I didn't know how to articulate that properly. So it came out as anger. It came out as acting out. It came out as all the behavioral pieces that I'd never looked at in my addiction before that was detrimental to me staying sober.
Kayla was eventually kicked out of the program after about 5 months. She hasn't gotten high or drunk since then. She said that's not because of the treatment she received at Synergy, but because she vowed to herself she would never again end up at a place like that. She found other resources to keep her sober. 10 years later, she's now living in Virginia with her wife and two kids.
I am grateful for every second I spent in that shithole. Because I am a firm believer, like, we walk our paths. It's how we land here. But I will say that I left there with more trauma than I had going in. And I don't think that's why they opened that place. So therein lies my beef.
Many who have sought substance abuse treatment have described it as hard to access and navigate. Adding in work therapy, with its combination of shame and punishment rooted in stigma, can make recovery harder. Jennifer Carroll, the researcher at North Carolina State, says these programs may reflect more on how society wants to handle crime and addiction, rather than what actually works.
Sometimes we're giving people the treatment because it's the right treatment for what they have, and sometimes we're giving people an intervention because we like the intervention, because we think it's the appropriate thing to do, and because we have decided that there is some moral or personal value in undertaking this, not because the science tells us that it is likely to be helpful.
Carroll says work therapy may be what some people want or need for themselves, and they should have that option. But these programs can easily become ripe for exploitation when there aren't other options readily available.
I live in a city where one of these programs that has a very, very heavy labor load operates. And when we talk to people who have been in and out of this program, a lot of them have notes about what happened there and feelings about the program that they were subjected to, but have comments like, but you know what? They were the only people who would help me. I had nowhere else to go. And that's the part that troubles me greatly, is the, I had nowhere else to go.
You've been listening to Season 3 of Civil Wrongs, a podcast by the Institute for Public Service Reporting and WKNO-FM, supported by Report for America. This podcast was produced by me, Laura Cabetta Chumesi, and edited by Christopher Blank. The music was composed and produced by Andrew J. Crutcher. A special thanks to the West Virginia Press and the Hancocks family for their permission to use clips from the song Raggedy Raggedy Are We. If you like what you heard, check out our previous seasons at civil-wrongs.org. Be sure to leave us a review wherever you're listening to this podcast and share with your people.